three of them deal with how God is going to destroy or going to judge the nations that have persecuted Israel over the years, and even then giving the reason why they did persecute Israel in chapter 11. Then in chapters 12 to 14 comes the time where God is going to establish his kingdom, but the very first thing that God must do before he can reign is in chapters 12 and 13, he must purify the land. So the land is purified, and then Christ comes to establish himself as king in the holy city, which will then be holy because he, the Holy One, will be there. As we come to these last six chapters, it is significant because in chapter 9 especially, what we do have is a foretaste of what God is going to do, in the sense that what he gives to us in this section are some of the prophetic things which at this point in time, and as we saw last week, at the point in time when Peter wrote, when he said we have an even more sure word of prophecy, the reason for that being is that as God predicted what was going to happen in the future, some of that was still future to the disciples. And yet some of it had already been fulfilled, so he could look back and with the other disciples say, we have an even surer word of prophecy than they did, because we have seen the reality of God's productive truth coming to pass, and therefore because we've seen what God did in the past, we believe what God will do in the future. And it is in this context that we looked at chapter 9 last week. And we saw that at the beginning of chapter 9 is, really in chapters 9 verses 1 through 8, is the conquest of Alexander the Great. He was the one coming to rule, but as we saw last week, it's Alexander the Great without a doubt. Even those who are liberal scholars will say as much. But the significant truth, as much as it is he that is described in this passage, fulfilling the prophecy of God, the statement is made in chapter 9, verse 1, that is, as he is moving, he fought the battle of the Granicus River as he crossed over into Asia Minor. He comes over just north of Palestine, right near where Paul was from, and he fought the battle of Issus there, which opened up all of the area of Palestine to him. And as he starts down through Palestine, it says in verse 1, the eyes of men, especially of all the tribes of Israel, are toward the Lord. Making the statement that it was surely then as true as it is now, and that is that God is the divine controller of all of human history. There is nothing that happens by accident. It's all designed by God. He raises up kings, he puts them down. And as you and I watch what happens, whether in this nation or other nations of the world, we are really watching the Lord. And so therefore our eyes of all men, and especially, well, if we could put this in our day, the eyes of men, especially of all believers, are toward the Lord. It should be, because he is the one who controls all of the affairs of human history. We saw that what he did, first of all, is come to Tyre and Sidon, and Tyre was a very prosperous city, and the reason it was is because they had built themselves a fortress. Well, they were very wise in verse 2. They'd built themselves a fortress. Actually, what they'd done is build a city that was off in the water on an island, so therefore they're away from the mainland, so people could not get to them, and had fortressed themselves up. They'd piled up silver like dust, gold like the mire of the streets, and yet here the Lord, to whom Israel was looking, will, he says, dispossess her. This was some 200 years after the prophecy was given that this would transpire. Cast her wealth into the sea, and she will be consumed with fire. And that's exactly what happened. Ashkelon saw it and was afraid. But you see, Gaza, as we saw last week, the king was not willing to open his gates up and was not that afraid, so therefore he kept his gates locked. They writhed in great pain. Why? Because it took 5 months to break into Gaza, and therefore because of that, the latter part of verse 5, the king will perish from Gaza. Alexander the Great killed the king by dragging him through the streets of the city. And then what Alexander did, he says a mongrel race will dwell in Ashdod. He took the people of Ashdod, the Philistines, moved them elsewhere, brought in other people into the land so that he might mix them so that they would not fight so zealously for their land again. And then he says in this context that he was going to camp, verse 8, around my house because of an army, because of him who passes by. That's Alexander. He went down into Egypt and returns. He came up from Egypt. And no oppressor will pass over them anymore, for now I've seen with my eyes. So God was going to peacefully protect Israel without war from that enemy that would at least possibly come upon them. We saw that what he does now is move in chapter 9 to verses 9 and 10, which is somewhat we want to begin this evening just briefly. And we see the rejoicing of God's people in 9, 9 to 10. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. As shout in triumph, O daughter of Jerusalem. The center focus of this book and this passage is not only upon Israel, it is upon the city of Jerusalem. And in fact, if you go back to chapter 14, when everything is concluded in this book, you will find that again, the center focus of all of this is Jerusalem again. It says, the day is coming in chapter 14, verse 1, the Lord's, when the spoil taken from you will divide among you, and I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle. So the issue here is we're centering on Jerusalem, on Zion. So rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout in triumph, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. He is just and endowed with salvation, humble and mounted on a donkey, even on a colt, the foal of a donkey. What we saw last week is, as you look at verse 9, is the coming of Christ fulfilled in his triumphal entry. When he entered into the city, and do you remember the story, they threw the palms in front of him, they cried Hosanna to him, and then a week later were crying, crucify him. But in verse 9 we have the coming of this king, but in verse 10 it is when he comes again to establish his kingdom upon this earth. And it is described in verse 10, what is not clear here as you look at this, except as we look back from this vantage point in time, is that there are at least 2,000 years between verses 9 and 10. The people, the disciples of the Lord could not tell that, and that's why they asked when was the kingdom going to come, especially when he rode into the city like this. They felt that then the rest of the prophecy would be fulfilled, and if he presented himself this way, surely the rest was going to happen. The prediction of the rest is, I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the horse from Jerusalem. As you know, and in fact, later in this same passage, you notice in verse 13, I will bend Judah as my bow, I will fill the bow with Ephraim. At the time of Rehoboam, you recall that Jeroboam rose up and the kingdom was divided with the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. Northern kingdom identified often as Ephraim, the southern kingdom identified as Judah. And so here in this context, he's dealing with the northern and the southern kingdom, and he says, I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim. They were forever fighting each other. And not only certainly fighting each other, there was the warfare with the other parts of the world, but basically a lot of warfare between each other, which we're going to see. In fact, go with me to chapter 11 just momentarily. An interesting statement, when the Lord is rejected by his people, and he will be rejected by them. Notice what he comments about what he's going to do. He says, verse 10, I took my staff favor and cut it in pieces to break my covenant which I had made with all the peoples. When the Lord Jesus Christ came, he had two staves. Verse 7, one called favor, the other called union. The favor was the favor that Israel had with the nations of the world. And by the way, the reason they don't have favor with the rest of the world today is because they rejected the Messiah, and therefore he cut off the staff called favor. It is theirs. It is not anybody else's. So he says, I will cut off favor. I will cut it in pieces to break my covenant which I have made with all the peoples to keep them from coming against Israel. So it was broken on that day. And thus the afflicted of the flock who were watching me realized it was the word of the Lord. And then it is interesting because in verse 14, then I cut my second staff union in pieces to break the brotherhood between Judah and Israel. Now you see, as long as the people of Israel are worshiping the Lord and honoring the Lord like they should, two things are going to happen. He's going to unite the two parts of the empire, Israel and Judah, Ephraim and Judah. Ephraim and Jerusalem here, he's going to unite the two parts of the empire. Secondly, he's going to give them favor with the nations of the world. But the minute they reject him, both of those are cut off. And by the way, we're going to address something here this evening, because we're going to come to the time of the Maccabees that leads up to the time of the coming of Christ. What is fascinating, and we'll get to the Maccabees in a while because they're referred in this passage. In the period, about 175 to 165, and actually 175, 163, in that period of time, there was the rising up of the Maccabeans and the establishing of the Maccabean household. Actually, only one person really known as Maccabees, and that was Judas, but we'll leave that go and we'll come back to that. But it's interesting because he established, and it is what happened is, all of his sons, the sons of Mattathias, ruled at one point in time, and then it started, the line was started going down. Until what happened is two of the brothers started fighting. The reason they started fighting was because the youngest one was ruling, and the oldest one didn't care. Aha. Herod the Great's father, who was an Idumean, had nothing to do with the Jewish people, except he saw a way to power. He went and got the oldest brother, and he says, you know what, this isn't good, you know, that your younger brother's ruling you? He didn't even care. But this man made him care. Went to the elders of Israel and said, look what you're doing. And so what he did, he got the two of them fighting each other. All right? When these two started fighting each other, then both of them saw some help, because the Romans weren't even who they were fighting against. They were fighting against the Syrian Empire. Now what happens, the Romans are around, and both brothers said, well, let's go to the Romans for help. And the Romans said, we'll help you. That is why, okay, because of the fighting between these two brothers in Israel who called in the Romans to help, that is why the Romans came in and took over, and then they cried out to God and said, release us from these people. They asked for it. It's amazing. Amazing to watch the history. You see, the interesting thing, as long as they served God, there was unity. When they failed to serve God, the disunity came so quickly. And so here in this context like this, when the Messiah comes and he begins to rule, he will unite these two parts of the empire. At the present time, or this point in time anyhow, the division was there. And so the hope for Israel, as we go back here again, and we'll come to chapter 11 later, but the hope again was that one day the two would be united. So God would cut off the war chariot from Ephraim. He would cut off the horse from Jerusalem. No more fighting. The bow of war will be cut off. Is it not significant that he will speak peace to the nations? He will speak peace. It isn't that he's going to fight and make peace. He is going to speak peace. Just as God spoke and the world came to be, so God will speak and peace will come to be. Is it not also interesting that his dominion would be from sea to sea? And some have tried to figure out, it can't be restricted to the land of Palestine. It's far too big from that. From the rivers to the ends of the earth, God is going to have dominion over the whole earth. There's going to be peace over the whole earth. This is when he comes again. Now, in light of this comes verses 11 to 17 that we would like to draw your attention to this evening. What I have done here is summed these up by the various headings that are given in these passages. So let's go first of all to verses 11 to 13, and then we will we'll follow through each one of these sections. As for you also, this is going back to Zion. Zion is the center focus of everything. As for you also, the city of Jerusalem, Zion, the people of Israel, because of the blood of my covenant with you. Do you, the blood of God's covenant. One can go back and say, which covenant? Is it the Palestinian covenant? God will give them the land. Is it the Davidic covenant? God will establish a kingdom. Is it the Mosaic covenant that God has established with his people, that is on the basis of the blood that was sacrificed on the altar, is a basis of the relationship to him? You can even go back to the Abrahamic covenant, where Abraham was caused to, he could cut the animals in half, and then God puts him in a sense of sleep where he can see the vision of what God does, and God is the only one who walks through between those animals. And you see, in every case, the blood, of course, is that which God uses to seal the covenant. Of course, the ultimate sealing of any covenant that God has made with Israel or with anybody was the blood of Calvary. And so at this point, he says, on the basis of this, the covenant that I have, because of the blood of my covenant with you, God has a covenant. I have set, because of this covenant, because of the covenant that I made with you that is established upon blood, I have set your prisoners free from the waterless pit. Or cistern in which there is no water, your margin says. What's this deal about a waterless pit? You know what? They used to do this. And who was put down in a waterless pit? Huh? Who was put in a waterless pit only to be drawn out, huh? Joseph. Yeah, Joseph put it, Jeremiah was put in a pit too. His got water in it, though, that one. He was having trouble, sunk up to his pits, but you're right. Anyhow, he was put in a pit. They used to put them in pits like this, but you know what? If Joseph had been put in a pit with water, we wouldn't have known anything about Joseph because he would no longer have existed, yes? So what's the point of this? I'll put you in a waterless pit. In other words, even though you go through adversity, you're not going to be overcome by the adversity. So I'll put you in a waterless pit, see? There is going to be persecution, there's going to be unrest, but not to the point of destroying you. So therefore, return to the stronghold. By the way, if you have an NASB, you'll notice in the margin it has stronghold with a capital S. Why? Because Israel's stronghold is what? It is certainly not Jerusalem. It is what? It is the Lord himself. That's why they have returned to the strongholds of capital, because the whole issue of this thing, the hope of Israel, is the hope of their relationship to God, and it goes back to the blood of my covenant with you. Return to the stronghold. God is Israel's stronghold, O prisoners who have the hope. This very day I'm declaring I will restore double to you. What is this double to you? You know where it is fascinating? The story that comes is, you remember when Elijah is about to be taken up? So he says to Elisha, what would you like? Elisha says, and remember, just go back with the account of it. Elijah started a school of the prophets, right? And these prophets are following Elijah and Elisha till they come to the river. And when they come to the river, there are just the two of them here, and the prophets are standing watching what's going to happen. So Elijah says, why don't you stay here? And Elisha says, no, I'm going with you to the end. So Elijah takes the mantle off, and he strikes the water, and the water parts, and they walk through to the other side. And these prophets are watching this happen. So then Elijah comes up to the point where he's about to be taken. And he asks, you know, Elisha what he'd like. And he says, I want a double portion of your spirit. Now you look at this, and there are some who take that and think, aha, see what that means is, if you look at Elisha, he did twice as many miracles as Elijah did. So he had a double. That's not what that means. There's nothing to do with that. There are a whole bunch of prophets there who have been taught by Elijah and in the school started by Elijah. What Elisha is saying, you see what the double portion went to the eldest son. And Elisha is saying, I want to be the heir of that which you have been doing in ministry. I want to carry on what you have started. I want, you know, there are a whole bunch of prophets out here, but I want to be the heir of your ministry. He's not saying I want to do twice as much as you did. What kind of audacity is that, that he who's been learning from Elijah would ask for such a thing? Is that what he asked for? See, the double portion was given to the eldest son. And so he says, I want a double portion. I want to be the one who carries on the ministry you began. I've been watching you, walking with you. Now I want to take the place. And what's exciting is he did so many of the same kinds of miracles that Elijah had done. Now, the point made here, which is very, very clear, is no doubt he says, I will give you a double portion. Why? Because Israel is, Zion is, God's choice, God's inheritor, if you will. They are God's firstborn. And so therefore, as he looks at this, he says, I'm not going to put you in a waterless pit, which means you're not going to be consumed. You are going to survive. I'm telling you to return to me, you prisoners, because there is hope. In fact, I am declaring to you that I am going to put you back in a place where you have double favor. You are going to be my definite anointed heirs. Now, he then says, now he's going to explain this. For I will bend Judah as my bow. I will fill the bow with Ephraim. Ephraim will be the arrows. Judah will be the bow. You know, the great thing is going to unite the two together, and they're going to fight together. I mean, in the sense of, if he said, I'll make you both bows or whatever, the sense that they are going to unite together, a bow is no good without arrows. Arrows don't go very far without a bow. And so therefore, what he's suggesting in here is the two parts of the nation are going to be united together. They're going to strive together, fight together, work together. By the way, is it not significant when he goes on to say, I will stir up your sons, O Zion, against the sons, your sons, O Greece? You know, it's interesting because he granted them victory or protection in the first part of this chapter when Alexander came without fighting. Here he's going to do it with fighting. God doesn't always work the same way. Let me tell you the story. I will make you, he says, like a warrior's sword, like the sword of a hero is literally what it is, the sword of a strong man. You're going to be bow and arrow. You're going to work together. You're going to labor together. I'm going to make you strong. as a sword would be in the hand of a hero. And I'm going to stir up your sons. I'm going to wake them up, literally is what it is. I'm going to wake up your sons, O Zion, against your sons, O Greece. Exciting how God did that. And I'm not going to go into the whole story, but it's interesting because we talk about Antiochus. Antiochus Epiphanes, and I'm not going to go into the history of that, but well, let me tell you how it happened, okay? Just briefly. Alexander the Great, when he divided his empire up, he divided up and he put Ptolemy down. He put him in four different places, but they're not the four kingdoms that you find stated in scripture at the beginning. That happened years later. Down in Egypt, where he had set up a major center, in fact, he called the city Alexandria after himself. He set up a library down there. He is the one who started the translation or the initiated the idea of the translation of the Septuagint. All of this comes from Alexander. As young as he was, as short a time as he was there. Alexander gives that area, or that area is taken by Ptolemy. Ptolemy's smart. He is one of the leaders of Alexander's army. And when Alexander dies at a young age and this empire is divided up, he takes the section down in Egypt because you know what? He can build a kingdom down there and nobody is passing by. He's not going to get a lot of trouble, okay, because he's down there away from everybody. You get up there in Macedonia, which is where part of his kingdom was divided. You get up there and people are passing through. You get in Palestine. You know why it's always been a problem? Because it's that pathway from the north to the south, and you've got to go through there to get anywhere. And so because of this, it was always the buffer. Well, under this man, Ptolemy, was a general of his, who finally decided, you know, he wanted to do something, so he went up and fought against one of the generals who was ruling the area of Syria, and he took that over. And what happened is, there are two names that they kept going back and forth. They called themselves Seleucid one time, Antiochus another time, and that's where Antioch comes from. There are several Antiochs, all named after, again, this family. All right. One of these, okay, what they did, they took over the area of Palestine, the northern part of Palestine, up where Antioch is. And then what happened is he started fighting his former boss, Ptolemy, and they used to fight over that center section, which happened to be Palestine or Israel. And so one would take it, then the other take it back, then the other take it, and the other take it back. And basically, they wanted as a buffer zone. They also wanted because the trade route ran through there. Now, in the process of time, there comes this fellow by the name of Antiochus Epiphanes. Well, what's happened, you know, and Israel started this thing. You know what, when they came back in the land, the Syrians says, you know, the one thing, and it started way back before them, they said, we don't want to put one of the line of David in there as a governor because he might claim himself to be a king again and say, I'm a king, so let's make the high priest the one in charge. And you know, they thought, this is incredible. It's like someone said, let's make a preacher the president. Let's make Billy Graham the president of the United States. You know what, that'd be a good idea. Not because he couldn't be a good president, but because, you see, those two don't even mix together. Keep the man where the religious part is, right? And so they decided they put these priests there, and they put them the highest official of the land. And pretty soon it became an incredibly political issue. And instead of being the religious exercise, now it's a political exercise, and they're getting themselves involved in all kinds of politicking. So one of them paid a bribe and got himself put in as the high priest. Well, why not? Hey, and again, to these people, Antiochus, this is no big deal. If you're going to act like a governor, then I'll treat you like a governor, right? And governors get in by bribing. If you pay me more money, I put you in there. If you promise me more taxes, I'll put you in there. So therefore, he changed the high priest and put somebody else in there. Well, when he was out of town, they heard he died, and they said, all right, so they began to celebrate and take over, but he hadn't died, you see. And he showed up back on the scene, and he was angry. Now, you see, we look at this when he went into the temple and desecrated the temple and said, you sacrifice pigs on the altar. And we say, oh, this terrible, the man was anti-Jew. No, 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 the man was saying to them, hold it, I'm in charge here. And I got to tell you, I put people in power, I take them out of power. And when you think you can go do what you want, you're under my rule, and I'm going to show you you're under my rule, and therefore this is what you're going to do. Now, it doesn't make it right. It's why he did it, okay? Well, there was a man by the name of Mattathias who was living in Jerusalem, an old priest, and he says, you know what, I don't need this kind of problem at this stage of my life. So I'm heading back to my home. He lived up in the hills, so he said, I'm heading back and moved back to my home in Modena. I'm going to live there, and I don't want this mess, okay? Well, lo and behold, God's not going to let you get away with that kind of stuff often. So they showed up in Modine and they said, you know what? We want you to sacrifice a pig on this altar. Well, Mattathias is the oldest one there. He is therefore the priest they're looking to. He ran away from Jerusalem to get away from this mess, and now it comes right to his doorstep, and he's told, sacrifice a pig on this altar. And he says, I will not sacrifice a pig on this altar. Say to his kids, sacrifice a pig on this altar. If you don't sacrifice a pig on this altar, we bring war to the town, this little town up in the mountains, and we destroy your peace. And so some guy says, I want peace up here. So he says, I'll sacrifice a pig on the altar. Mattathias says, no, you won't sacrifice a pig on this altar. So he sacrificed this man and killed him. He killed the emissary who'd come from the Syrian thing, and thus came what's known as the Maccabean Wars. Mattathias is soon to die. His son Judas takes over. His name is Maccabeus, the hammer, the exterminator. It is under him that they begin warfare. And why they could beat the Syrians is because they did so much guerrilla warfare. They knew the mountains well. They knew how to hide. They knew how to fight this way. And finally they take over Jerusalem once again. Finally they take over the temple once again. And that's why we have Hanukkah today. It is. All goes back to that. You see, I remember one day, I see someone with all of these things like we have. I'm in a Jewish home, and this is terrible. I should know better. But anyhow, I'm in this Jewish home. They have all of this stuff, and I think, you know what? They're just borrowing from us. You know what? We came up with a date later than they came up with a date. They had, anyhow, whatever. It is amazing because Hanukkah came before Christmas came, but that's all right. We're at the same time. But Hanukkah came from there. It's the Feast of Lights. It's a celebration of the fact that they were able once again to get the temple back and sacrifices they should. God raised up, woke up. He did. He woke them up. They were sound asleep. They did not want to fight. And God made them fight. And God rose, woke up the sons of Israel or Zion, and made them fight against the sons of Greece. And they won. You know what the problem with them is? They got back Jerusalem. They got back the center of worship. They could keep worshiping like they want. Now they're in charge. But you know what? They weren't satisfied. They want to expand their kingdom. And then they got this division because they were fighting over who was going to rule. And then neither of them ruled. And pretty soon the Romans took over again. But for a brief period of time in there, God raised up the sons of Jerusalem against the sons of Greece. The Maccabean period, an incredible time in Israel's history to which they now even still look back. So we're back to this. So you notice this is what happens. God says, I'm going to do it. Now, can I remind you again now? Do you remember this? That this is Zechariah prophesying this. He prophesied Alexander hundreds of years before it happened. He prophesied the Maccabean uprising hundreds of years before it happened. Likely, again, this prefigures because this is really going beyond that. This is not just about that period of time, but notice what happens. He then says, then the Lord will appear over them. He's going to be over them, but in two ways he's going to be over them, because he's ruling from heaven. And notice what happens is, and it'll go down, let's pick up the last line of verse 14, he will march in the storm winds of the south. Why the storm winds of the south? Huh? What's in the south of Palestine? What is it? It's desert. I mean, you watch it, right? It's where Desert Storm was, all this. And so you have a storm that comes up from the south. What's going to hinder its approach? Nothing. By the way, when David escaped from Absalom, he went over the Jordan River. And you know what he had to do? He went up in the heights like this to get over. And that's just the way you don't escape. But God protected him as he did it that way. And he's up there. There are mountains in that area. That's just not the way you go. If you're gonna go, anyhow, the whole point, there are mountains here, so it stops if that way, but there's desert in the south, and it's a straight shot right up the south like that. So basically, when a storm starts from the south against Palestine, there's nothing to hinder it. And so therefore, a storm from the south is a mighty storm, and God who is over them is going to be, and he uses this as the picture, he's going to march in the storm winds of the south. His arrows will go forth like lightning. Lightning is going to be the arrows of God. Thunder will be the trumpet of God. And God is going to fight in their behalf. He will appear over them. He will march in the storm winds of the south. His arrow will go forth like lightning, and the Lord God will blow the trumpet and call them to battle. Then verse 15, the Lord of hosts will defend them. Now notice how he does this. They will devour. The picture here, and in fact, just wait. Go back with me. The passage, do you remember? Balaam and Balak, do you remember the story, right? And Balak says to Balaam, I want you to curse these people, right? And every time he wants to do it, he says, well, I need to go here and do some sacrifice. And everywhere he goes, there's nothing but blessing. Go back with me just quickly to Numbers chapter 23, just for a moment. Numbers 23, and notice what God predicts will happen. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, right? 23. So Balak is called Balaam to sacrifice and they did a burnt offering and to bring this judgment against Israel. So he gets up there. And Balak asks him in verse 17, what has the Lord spoken? And he took up this discourse, verse 18, Numbers 23, and said, arise, O Balak, and hear. Give ear to me, O son of Zippor. God is not a man that he should lie, nor a son of man that he should repent. Has he said, and will he not do it? Or has he spoken, and he will not make it good? Behold, I have received a command to bless. When he is blessed, when he is blessed, then I cannot revoke it. Now, what is the blessing? Go down with me, if you will. Well, let us look at this next part. He has not observed misfortune in Jacob, nor has he seen trouble in Israel. The Lord, his God, is with him, and the shout of a king is among them. God brings them out of Egypt. He is for them like the horns of the wild ox. For there is no omen against Jacob, nor is there any divination against Israel. At the proper time it should be said to Jacob and to Israel what God has done. Now notice, behold, a people rises like a lioness, and as a lion it lifts itself. It shall not lie down until it devours the prey and drinks the blood of the slain. Keep those words in mind, because it's the prediction of what God's going to do through Israel. They're going to devour like a lioness. They're going to drink the blood of the slain. Go back with me now, if you will, to chapter 9. Look at what God says back in chapter 9 with regard to what's going to happen with Israel. When he brings them into the place of defending them, it says they will devour. They're going to eat their enemies like a lioness eats its enemies. They're going to trample on the sling stones. What's that about? The enemies, back then they're using slings like David used, right? And they're going to sling these stones at Israel, but God's going to divert these stones. And they're just walking along like this. The stones are coming. They don't do any damage. They just walk on these stones. They don't get hit by the stones. They're not affected by the stones. They just walk on the stones as if, do what you want. You can't touch me. So they walk on the sling stones. They're not affected by them. Notice what else they will do. They will drink. We saw that back there. They're going to devour. They'll drink the blood. They're going to be boisterous as with wine. They're going to celebrate as drunken people would do. But now listen to this. They will be filled like a sacrificial basin. Do you know when the priests sacrificed for the altar, they would cut the throat, of course, of the animal they were slaying, and as the blood flowed, they would catch the blood in a basin and then take this blood and put it on top of the sacrifice again to be sacrificed with the sacrifice or to burn with the sacrifice. And he says, these people are going to be like a sacrificial basin. They're going to be catching the blood of their enemies. Notice the next thing, drenched like the corners of the altar. Well, what happens on the altar? When the altar of burnt sacrifice, when you're sacrificing and you kill an animal, put up there, the blood begins to go out and it touches the four corners of this altar. And basically he is giving to them a description of what it's going to be like when Israel goes to battle. The blood is going to flow. They're going to catch the blood of the enemies. The blood is going to be sprayed everywhere as they bring about victory over the enemies of God. Now notice, this is where we were singing this evening. It comes from this passage. And the Lord, their God, will save them in that day. Now, you just quickly go through here and miss maybe something, but I want you to see it. Go with me to chapter 12 for a while and just quickly follow down with me. I'm not going to get all of them, just a few of them. Notice what happens. There's a term, that day, that comes in chapters 12 through 14. It's all over the place. Notice in verse 3 of chapter 12, it'll come about in that day. Look at verse 4, in that day. Look at verse 6, in that day. Look at verse 8, in that day. Go down with me to verse 9. It'll come about in that day. All the way through in verse 11, in that day. We can go down in verse 13, verse 1, in that day. Verse 2 of chapter 3, come about in that day. It goes down to chapter 14 the same way. Verse 4 of chapter 14, in that day. Just to say to you, that day runs from chapters 12 to 14 is the future eschatological day when Christ is going to come and reign and his people are going to be there. And God says, going back to chapter 10, it is going to happen in that day, that future eschatological day, chapter 9 I should say, come about in that day that the people will be as the flock of his people. The flock of his people. He is going to be the great shepherd of his people. In fact, he says in chapter 10, verse 3, my anger is kindled against the shepherds. And in fact, the reason for that, in the latter part of verse 2 of chapter 10, they're afflicted because there is no shepherd. In chapter 11, what happens, God is bothered because it says in verse 5, the last line of verse 5, and their own shepherds have no pity on them. So he is going to become the shepherd. And we'll look at that in a few weeks. But it's interesting because he wants to shepherd his people Israel. And he is going to be their shepherd. And they're going to be his sheep. And then he says, they are as the stones of a crown sparkling in his land. Israel is going to be like the jewels of a crown sparkling in the land of Palestine. If you go with me just one more book to Malachi chapter 3 and verse 17. It says in verse 17 of Malachi 3, they will be mine, says the Lord of hosts, on that day that I prepare my own possession. And basically what that my own possession is literally in that point when I make up my own jewels. So what happens is Israel is going to be the special jewels of God in that future eschatological day when God comes back to establish his kingdom once again. So he says, what's going to happen? They're going to be like the flock of his people. They're going to be his sheep and he's going to be their shepherd. They're going to be stones or jewels of the crown sparkling in his land. And wherever they go, the people of God will be those who sparkle as a display of his glory as they reflect it. And the reason for that in verse 17 is what comeliness and what beauty will be theirs. God's people are going to be beautiful in that day. In fact, they're going to be attractive in that day. As we saw in a previous chapter, the Gentiles are going to grab hold of them and want to go where they're going. Grain will make the young men flourish and new wine the virgins. It's going to be a great day, a day when Christ is going to come as the king and Israel is going to be raised to the place of prominence. They're going to be his warriors. They're going to be his flock. They're going to be his jewels. They're going to be so beautiful. Chapter 10, verse 1 should be connected with chapter 9. There should not be a break. And I just want to read this to you because it's a transitional verse that goes into what's in chapter 10. But listen to this. This is the reminder to his people. You know, it's so easy when you think of blessing to go somewhere else to try to get it. But God says, understand, I am the one who does all of this. I am the one who blesses you. I am the one who makes the young men flourish like grain and the new wine, the virgins. I am the one who does that. Why do you go ask somebody else? See, verse 2 of chapter 10, you go to the teraphim. You go to the diviners. You go to false dreams. You go everywhere else trying to seek an answer. Ask the rain from the Lord at the time of the spring rain, the Lord who makes the storm clouds. And he will give them showers of rain, vegetation in the field to each man. You know, the reminder is the only way that blessing will ever come to Israel is because God intervenes. And he says, instead of trying to manufacture your own way, understand that the only answer to your problems is me. Actually, that's not good grammar. The only answer to your problem is I. I am the answer, God says. And you keep going everywhere else to trying to find a solution to your problem. And Israel is today. And until Israel comes to a place where they go to ask God, the provider of the rain, the provider of strength, the one who will make them his sheep and make them the jewels of his crown, Israel is reminded, you know what? The only one answer is come to me. Don't go somewhere else. He says, you drink from broken cisterns. And so anyhow, the reminder to us too, you know, when it comes to blessing, blessing comes only from God. He says, ask from me, and I am the one who provides the blessing, physical, spiritual, whatever way it is from God himself. Great passage.